Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to our Through the Bible podcast. This is Josh Swanson, lead pastor at Christ Church in Sierra Madre. So today, we are launching out in the book of Numbers. Now, I'll be honest, of all of the first five books of Moses, the Pentateuch, Numbers is the one I am least familiar with. And it is the one also, I should say, that I have done the most skim reading over the years. You know, have you experienced this? You're reading through the Bible and you come to these sections and some are just rich and you want to chew on it and meditate and think about, and you just feel like the promise of God is so rich and beautiful. And then other stuff you come to and you're just like, is this chapter ever going to end? It's so long and there's so many numbers. And the book of Numbers contains a lot of chapters with, guess what? Numbers. And it is aptly named. So for example, in chapter one, you have a census with lots of numbers. Of the people of the tribe of Gad, for example, there were 45,650. The people of the tribe of Issachar, there were 54,400. Of Zebulun, 57,400. Of Manasseh, 32,200. And then in chapter two, you get the arrangement of Israel in camps around the tabernacle. And you have more numbers. And so, for example, all those listed at the camp of Judah by their companies was 186,400. And all those listed of the camp of Reuben were 151,450. And then you have the duties of the Levites in chapter 3. And again, you have more and more numbers. For example, chapter 3, verse 39, all those listed among the Levites, whom Moses and Aaron listed at the commandment of the Lord, by clans, all the males from a month old and upward, there were 22,000, and so on and so forth. You get to chapter 4, and again, more numbers. You get to chapter 26. There's another lengthy census that has 89 verses in it, which is pretty substantive, right? 89 verses. And in chapter, actually, it wasn't chapter 36 that has 89 verses. It's chapter 7, which chapter 7 gives this list of different people who offered gifts for the tabernacle. And so, for example, on the eighth day, it said that Gamaliel, the son of Pedazar, the chief of the people of Manasseh, his offering was one silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, a golden dish of 10 shekels, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb, a year old, for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and so on and so forth. And then it goes on like this for 89 verses. And here's the thing, the same offering is repeated over and over and over and over and over again. And you thought after the first time, you're like, couldn't you have just summarized this? Like, and each person gave this same gift. But no, we have the same gift listed over and over and over again. And so I think because of that, the book of Numbers has turned a lot of people off, and maybe it's turned you off. Maybe you've tried it. And if you get through Leviticus, you know, God bless you. Like, you got through Genesis, Exodus, pretty exciting, cool reading. You get to Leviticus, it starts getting a little bit more challenging. And then you start slogging your way through the Numbers and Numbers, and you feel like, man, I don't know if I can make it all the way through the Bible. But don't give up. Keep reading. There's actually a lot of gold to be mined in the book of Numbers. So let me just note, by way of introduction, a few things about Numbers. So number one, kind of interesting, there is a greater variety of literary genres in the book of Numbers than in any other book in the Bible. It contains narrative, chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, poetry, chapter 21, prophecy, chapter 24, victory song, chapter 21, prayers, chapter 12, blessing, chapter 6, lampoon, chapter 22, lampoon. That's a good one, like, you know, kind of like a making fun of somebody, lampooning them. Diplomatic letter, chapter 21, civil law, chapter 27, cultic law, chapter 15, oracular discourse. I'm not really sure exactly what that is, chapter 15. But Jacob Milgram, whom I got this list from, says that's a type of literature. Census, temple archive, itinerary, and so on and so forth. And so you just get a lot of different types of literature, and it seems kind of pieced together. And likely in its formation, it was sort of pieced together, which is why it reads that way. But its final form does have a certain coherence. And this leads us to our second observation about numbers. Numbers can be divided into three main sections. So we could think about numbers from the vantage point of geography, where the children of Israel is when the book is written. So Numbers is a sequel to the book of Leviticus. Leviticus, of course, is the sequel to Exodus, and Exodus is the sequel to Genesis. And so when you get to Numbers, you are continuing on the same story we were in before. And what was happening before? Well, Israel, you remember, was liberated from her bondage in Egypt. God challenged the tyrannical rule of Pharaoh. He set his oppressed people free. And then where does he take them? After he takes them out of Egypt, he brings them to Mount Sinai, where God is going to deliver his law to them. Because remember, God's ultimate goal is to take them out of slavery in Egypt and bring them into the promised land. God has promised to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and their descendants a land flowing with milk and honey. And in this land, they will experience the goodness of God. But in order to inherit the promised land, the holy land, they need to be a holy people. And so the holy God meets with them at Mount Sinai to give them his holy law so that they might be a holy people, thereby making themselves fitted to enter into the holy land. And so here they are at Mount Sinai, and God delivers his law to them. And of course, Leviticus talks about the priesthood that is established and the tabernacle that's now erected, and now the sacrificial system has been implemented. And you have this story being told, and when you open up Numbers, you are still at the foot of Mount Sinai, and God is giving his laws. And so in Numbers 1 through 10, it covers only 19 days, from the 1st to the 19th of the second month of the second year after Sinai. And so here they are at Mount Sinai, and God is giving him his laws. And so in these 10 chapters, you have the continued delivery of God's laws to his people. And specifically, the first 10 chapters, in addition to all these wonderful numbers and genealogies and census and lists and so on and so forth, you are also getting more laws to establish the Levitical priesthood, who will act as go-betweens between the nation and God, so that God's presence might dwell among his people. And so the first 10 chapters take place at the foot of Sinai. The second section in the book takes a different geographical location. Now, Israel is on a sojourn, and she is in a journey from chapter 10 through chapter 26. She is in her wilderness wanderings, and she is on her way. She is on journey toward the promised land. And so in these chapters, you see Israel in this space of where resources are thin, and she doesn't know where she's going to get her next meal, where she's going to find water to drink. And God provides for her in the wilderness. And she also experiences a great deal of rebellion and mistrust and doubt, and Israel's the most common verb to describe Israel in the wilderness is the verb murmur. And when Israel's going gets tough, Israel starts to complain. I wonder if anyone else has ever found themselves in their own wilderness season where resources are thin and you're struggling to get by and you don't know, you're not in the promised land. You know, you're not in Egypt anymore, but you're not in the promised land. And in the space between, our temptation is to murmur and complain that life is not the way we want it. And so chapters 1 through 10, Israel's at Sinai, completing the rules, the laws that are given to her. Chapters 10 through 26, she is journeying toward the promised land, and she is wandering through the wilderness. And another note about her sojourn in the wilderness is it's interesting because a lot of the events discussed in Exodus chapter 17 through 19. So between Israel being released from Egypt and coming to Sinai, there are some incidents reported. Israel cries out for bread. God provides manna. Israel is thirsty. God provides water. And God's presence sustains Israel there in the wilderness. But that wilderness segment is prior to Sinai. So in between Egypt and her arrival at Sinai, God provides, Israel is complaining. And a lot of similar kind of stories where Israel is hungry for bread or thirsty for water, those are recounted in Numbers 10 through 26. But here's the difference. In these accounts, Israel is complaining after Sinai. So Sinai is like the watershed moment where God meets with his people, the cloud descends, the fire, the lightning, the trumpet blasts, the presence of God appears, God enters into a covenant promise with his people. And after God delivers his law and reveals his presence on Sinai, the expectations are ratcheted up. And so the distinction between her experience in Exodus chapter 17 to 19 and her experience in Numbers chapter 11 through 26 is that while she has the same need for bread, for water, she experiences oftentimes God's provision. After Sinai, Israel is also going to experience God's anger, because now the expectations are higher. God has already provided once. God has already provided water. God has already shown himself to be the God who will provide for them and sustain for them. And now God is expecting something more, which of course, you know this if you're a parent and you're raising kids. You know, you have a certain level of expectation on your children when they're little. And when they get older and they have seen you provide, care for them, supply for them, and you start to expect a little bit more as the journey goes on. And it's true at work. You know, you start a new job, and when you're just learning and you're in that probationary period or they're training you or whatever, you know, the expectations are on one level. But look, after you've received the full training, after you have been deputized for your new role and your new job, we've got some different expectations, and we've already made that mistake once. And so we go back to that again, and you're getting in trouble. And you sense that happening in the wilderness. After Sinai, the expectations are higher and the judgment becomes more severe, and God demands and expects more of his people. And so chapters 1 through 10, that's at Sinai. Chapters 11 through 26, that's on her journey toward the promised land. And then chapters 26 through 36 of Numbers take place in a third space. And this is just now 5 months shy of the 40th year. And so Israel has been wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. And now she is sitting at the entrance to the promised land. She's at the very borders of the promised land. And in this text, the land is apportioned and God is commanding his people not to defile the land when they get in there. So he's preparing his people to enter into the promised land. And so one way to understand or to read the book of Numbers is looking at it in these three geographical spaces. Part 1 through 10 at Sinai. Part 2, her journey from Sinai toward the promised land, kind of wandering in circles around in the wilderness. My goodness, how many of us can experience life like that sometimes? I'm just wandering in circles still in the wilderness. When am I going to get out and move into the promised land? And then the third space, chapters 26 through 36, right as she is on the border of the promised land. But a second way you could read the book of Numbers, not only geographically, that's one way in which it's been common to divide the book, but the second way is not geographically, it is generationally. So Numbers speaks of two generations, and this is really important. I think actually here is where I think Numbers starts to take on an almost archetypal character that so many of us can connect with and relate to. So there are two generations of Israelites depicted in Numbers. The first is spoken of in Numbers chapter 1 and what follows in chapter 1 through chapter 26. And that generation is the Exodus generation. This is the generation that came out of Egypt, and she has seen God provide for her again and again. She's witnessed God's presence out Sinai. And so there is the Exodus generation, and that generation is given in a census list in chapter 1. And then there's a second generation that's given to us in chapter 26, and there's a second census list there. And then what follows on chapter 26 and through 36 is descriptions of this new generation. And this now is not the Exodus generation. This is the Joshua / Caleb generation. And where the Exodus generation will be marked out in chapters 11 through 26 as a generation that murmurs and complains and is always misremembering the past, you know, is always thinking back into that time in Egypt when life was oh so good and we had leeks and garlics and we sat by the rivers and we ate, you know, bread to the full. You know, it's kind of like, did you really do that? No, you didn't. You're misremembering the past. Who hasn't misremembered the past among us? I think we all have. It's very common, especially when times get rough in the present. You always kind of look back, well, you know, I know, you know, this person is leading us into a new place, but wasn't the old place so much better? And you kind of misremember it. That's what Israel does in the wilderness. And this is the Exodus generation. She's marked by rebellion, by murmuring and complaining. But then there's a new generation, a younger generation that will enter into the promised land. And this generation, the Joshua and Caleb generation, is not marked by failure in the wilderness, but by faithfulness and trust in the promise of God. They believe that God will take her into the promised land. And it's interesting, there are two reports that are representative of these two generations of people when they go into the promised land. And Numbers 13 to 14, there's the classic account of the spies who go into the land of Canaan to kind of check things out. And they come back, and there are two reports about the promised land. Report one is Joshua and Caleb, and they are like, man, there are grapes the size of watermelons in this land, and we can go in there, and yeah, there's giants in the land, but we are going to eat them for lunch, and we're going to take the land. And then the second report is representative of the Exodus generation, and this is the people that look and say, look, you know, the giants are too large, and they're going to eat us for their lunch. And yeah, there's these big grapes and it's a land flowing with milk and honey, but there's no way we're going to enter into this land. And of course, the Joshua Caleb generation are speaking out of confidence and faith and trust in the promise of God who said, I will give you the land. The Exodus generation is speaking out of unbelief. And I think these two generations, the Joshua Caleb generation and the Exodus generation, represent, I think, two places we can find ourselves at any given time in our life. You know, we oftentimes find ourselves in that place in between our release from an old past and our entry into a future that God has for us. And sometimes we are unsure whether or not we can go into that future. And we are unsure of the leaders God has provided for us, you know, and can they really take us into the promised land? And can they really take us into a new future? And there's complaints and murmurs. And of course, churches can experience times like this, you know, where the primary posture of people is complaining and what's wrong and how come we're not doing this the way we used to do it? And there can be lots of complaining. And the Exodus generation, they die in the wilderness. They never enter into the promised land. But the Joshua generation, the Caleb generation, they see the land as that which God has already given to them. It is secure because it's been promised by God, and by God's power and strength, they can take this land. And so they move toward the borders of the land with faith and confidence in the promise of God. And that generation enters in and experiences the goodness of the land. And again, I think Numbers then is inviting us to reject the way of the Exodus generation, reject lives of murmuring and complaining and rebellion, and embrace a life of faith and trust and possibility and hope that involves risk and vulnerability, because you are going into a place with some dangers, but you trust God, I can move in there and we can go there and it's going to be okay. And so Numbers, in spite of having kind of a lackluster beginning, oftentimes, you know, all these numbers and everything, which of course in the ancient world, it did mean a whole lot more to them than oftentimes it means to us. But Numbers does have a weight of gold below the surface if we can mine underneath it and we can discern kind of what's happening here and how there are two paths that are set before us in this book. And there is so much in this book I think we can connect with and relate to. And so when we come back, we are going to start looking at a couple of the key sections in this book and see what God might have to say to us through these core sections. And I hope you will enjoy our time in Numbers.
Praise Father, Son, and